Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast from the magazine of free minds and free markets and free webathons. That doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't matter. We're in the final hours of our annual fundraising webathon. I'm giving you license to stop what you're doing at the end of the sentence only, comma, and go to reason.com/webathon, make a tax-deductible contribution. Make sure that when doing so that you leave a comment in the little feedback bucket, preferably something about how the Reason Roundtable is your very favorite part of the entire Reason enterprise. That's a period on the sentence. You can go do it. Now come back. Here we go. Speaking of which, I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, I think, and Catherine Mangu Ward, ho, 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 and such.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are going to talk about the remarkable series of events unfolding over in Syria here in a moment. But first, a word from one of our generous sponsors.
I'm going to tell you about Lumen, today's sponsor. Lumen is the world's first handheld metabolic coach. It's a device that measures your metabolism through your breath. And on the app, it lets you know if you're burning fat or carbs and gives you tailored guidance to improve your nutrition, workouts, sleep, even stress management. All you have to do is breathe into your Lumen first thing in the morning, and you'll know what's going on with your metabolism, whether you're burning mostly fats or mostly carbs. Then Lumen gives you a personalized nutrition plan for that day based on your measurements. You can also breathe into it before and after workouts and meals, so you know exactly what's going on in your body in real time. And Lumen will give you tips to keep you on top of your health game. I've used Lumen, and I've got to tell you, it really helps me to be more intentional and effective when it comes to diet and exercise. Your metabolism is your body's engine. It's how your body turns the food you eat into fuel that keeps you going. Because your metabolism is at the center of everything your body does, optimal metabolic health translates to a bunch of benefits, including easier weight management, improved energy levels, better fitness results, and better sleep. For women, Lumen can also track your cycle as well as the onset of menopause and adjust your recommendations to keep your metabolism healthy through hormonal shifts so you can keep up your energy and stave off cravings. If you want to stay on track with your health this holiday season, go to lumen.me/roundtable to get 15% off your Lumen. That's lumen.me/roundtable. For 15% off your purchase. Lumen makes a great gift, too.
Okay, over the weekend, the government of long-running Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad just straight up collapsed as rebel groups stormed the capital and the presidential palace and began the heartbreaking work of opening up some of the planet's most gruesome political prisons. Thus ends the this phase, anyway, of the 13-year-long Syrian civil war, and also the Assad family's 53-year brutal reign. Bashar fled for Moscow, where he's been granted asylum by his longtime military patron, Russia's Vladimir Putin, whose dreams of having a Mediterranean stronghold have collapsed kind of overnight. This amazing development also marks a setback for Assad's other two main backers, Lebanon's already reeling Hezbollah, Army of God, and the theocratic regime in Iran, whose quote-unquote axis of resistance has been on quite the losing streak ever since Hamas slaughtered 1,000 Israelis and took 200 more hostage 14 months ago. The biggest rebel faction in charge of Syria at the moment, as far as we know, is the Islamicist group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And that's the last time I'm ever going to try to pronounce that, HTS for short, which used to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Not good guys, and is officially designated by the United States as a terrorist organization. Regional powers, including Turkey, Israel, and these United States, have reacted to the power vacuum by bombing stuff and people, too. Now that Russia no longer controls Syrian airspace. Catherine, it's a big old mess, certain to get a big old messier. What are your initial reactions to all this crazy news?
Yeah, my initial reaction, I guess, is to pause for a moment and just say, like, good riddance to bad rubbish about Assad. He was truly a monster. And it's right to be afraid of what will come next. I personally am not super reassured by what seems to be at least one of the party lines, which is like, yeah, we used to be super al-Qaeda-y, but now we're like really more nationalist-y. Like that's to me is like, okay, okay. But my God, Assad was a long-standing nightmare for his people. You know, after in reaction to the Arab Spring, with the help of the aforementioned Hezbollah and Russian allies, he did horrific things to his own people. Just a little casual gassing on a Tuesday was absolutely did not bother him in the slightest. And to see him go, I understand the, you know, the images and recordings that I have seen of people just, you know, joyful in the streets.
Nick, there's a bit of daylight seemingly between the reactions to still President Joseph Robinette Biden II. I'm almost forgetting that one. And the perfume salesman, Donald Trump. Biden yesterday said that he is clear-eyed about the fact that ISIS will try to take advantage of any vacuum to reestablish its capability to create a safe haven. We will not let that happen. Thus, the aforementioned bombing raids on ISIS strongholds. Trump managed to do a Truth Social in which he said Russia, Russia, Russia for no particular reason, which is kind of great. But he seems to be more of the, you know, this is terrible. Russia made a mistake. Syria is weak. Now we should negotiate Ukraine. He's not as sort of we need to assert our prerogatives in Syria. What is your kind of take about the differing approaches and the role that the U.S. has played up till now?
Well, yeah, that's a gigantic question, Matt.
Sorry
and,
about that.
You know, as you were talking, I actually went and donated yet again for the fourth time to the Reason Webathon. So I just want to both brag and also kind of hopefully encourage our listeners or our watchers to do the same. Before time runs out on that. But going back to, you know, what our interests in Syria are, this was a big, you know, it was a massive problem. And your pinup boy, John McCain, was a major player in, you know, confusing what were American interests in Syria when we were actively involved in Iraq. I went back and looked at our coverage, you know, the way that Obama essentially improvised us into the conflict with his red line remark, which was off the cuff, and then he failed to follow it up. The American interests in Syria are really muddled and muddied. We want peace in the world. We want peace in the Middle East. But exactly what we can do to achieve any of this is unclear. And we demonstrated that over the past 20 years, you know, just to keep it in the 20th century. I think now one of the most interesting things about this is, you know, to the extent that HTS, not a boy band, but, you know, the new Syrian coalition. Yeah, they'll be coming out with that. If, in fact, they have shifted out of a more kind of expansionary Islamist model, coming out of al-Qaeda and whatnot, and they're actually more nationalist, this is a major, major change because, among other things, there's over 5.4 million Syrian refugees in the around the world. Most of them are in Turkey, and to the extent that they can start going back home after years, sometimes decades, of being out, there's almost 7 million people displaced within Syria. If they can start going back to a vaguely normal life, that is going to be like a massive change in the Middle East. And when you tack it on to the fact that Iran is partly depleted because for a variety of reasons, including the recent Israeli actions against them, Hezbollah is depleted, Hamas, which isn't really a factor in this, depleted. Like, we may be looking at a serious breakthrough in the Middle East, a year and change after one of the most barbaric assaults in recent memory. So I'm actually kind of optimistic about this. And I think this is where Trump, as a foreign policy guy, is better than Biden or was or Harris would have been, because what he wants is a negotiated settlement everywhere. And this is a good place to start. There's a lot of opportunity here to, you know, to just kind of stop massive ongoing bloodshed.
I would add to the Syrian migration, that is the root cause of the European migration or immigration crisis, which has roiled all of the politics, every single country basically in Europe. Who knows if people are going to go home from Scandinavia now or anytime soon, but it certainly would change the political dynamic there in a way that's pretty interesting. Peter, Nick's feeling a little bit optimistic. You are our group pessimist when it comes to international affairs and the imminence of World War III. How's your DEFCON meter? Is it going towards panic or a little bit away from it?
I mean, the thing is that we just don't know how this is going to go. Every single report is like, well, Assad's not the leader anymore, and something else is going to happen. Something else. We're going to find out what that something else is, because 2 weeks ago, no one assumed that we were going to be in this position today. I think possibly including even the rebels who carried out the attack, you know, HTS, those folks, it's not obvious that they even expected this level of success. And for a long time, this war has been going on for over a decade, this civil war. There have been various rebel groups fighting Assad for, it's something like 13 years. And in the U.S. intelligence machine operations, they sometimes referred to, well, what if the rebels win and actually deposed Assad? They said that would be a catastrophic success. And that may be what we have now is a catastrophic success, which is, yes, Assad is gone. And Assad was awful. He presided over the deaths of something like 3% of his population, 600,000 people killed, something like that. I mean, just a truly awful guy. But the people replacing him, the HTS folks in particular, have historical links, not just to Al-Qaeda, but to ISIS. They at least were at times really bad guys with really bad ideas. Now, there is some reason to hope that they have renounced those ideas, that the worst of those ideas, the most violent of them, that's no longer their ideology. Maybe that's true. There are U.S. Analysts who think it might be. From this, my position here in this podcast booth this morning, I have absolutely no idea what is going to come. And I don't think anybody else has any idea either. It might well be better, and it also might well be much worse. And this is always the thing that happens anytime you just forcibly eliminate a government that has ruled for decades. You never know what is going to come next, even if you have really clear plans and a vision for it. And in this case, there is not even that. So we'll find out, and so will they.
Peter said you on the forcibly eliminates and...
I meant you, Matt Nick's... Welch. Thanks. Former war blogger, Matt Welch.
More? Like, get it out of your system now.
Could you,
before I finish my
do you
sentence.
Still have the war blogger hat, Matt, that you used to wear?
I never had a war blogger hat, Nick. Oh, the Starbucks.
Your
Starbucks.
Picture
that
on a war blogger. Yeah, thank you. You know, Matt, the internet is going to fact check your ass.
Fascinating for everybody. 2013, we came so within 48 miles. Hours of the U.S. being the lead actors in the war against Bashar al-Assad. We've kind of memory hold that now, but Obama, as Nick was saying earlier, drew a red line suddenly, improvised one, in people like then Secretary of State John Kerry, with his horse-like face, giving stern lectures about, yeah, it's fine, I can horse face shame him if
he was the BoJack Horseman
yes,
of international
he
diplomacy.
Was. With a war blogger hat, he was making incredibly spurious comparisons to the U.S. not letting refugees in from Europe, Jewish refugees from Hitler's Germany. Like, none of it made sense, but we came very close, and it was basically England, Britain putting the vote to the House of Commons. Whether they were going to intervene in Syria, and the House of Commons repudiating that kind of led to a reverse dominoes. And there was a lot of people in the U.S. Senate led by Rand Paul, who deserves credit for that moment, in my view, saying, no, we shouldn't do this. And it was never a popular thing among the American public opinion and wouldn't have been. But the spirit of the times 11 years ago were such, there are still people who believe that, you know, it was a fantastic thing that we deposed Muammar Gaddafi. That really went well in Libya. So I think one of the good things about what happened over the weekend is that so far, at least, you can't say, although some will absolutely be saying it, but that this was led by the United States of America. For whatever happened, it seems like there were other people going.
At the same time, it's also not... It's not the case that the United States played no role in Syria at all over the last decade,
Did I
right?
Say I mean,
No. Just so listen, not that you said this, but just so that listeners understand here. And I would just refer everyone back to an absolutely incredible LA Times headline from 2016. In Syria, militias armed by the Pentagon fight those armed by the CIA. So that's what's been going on there.
And will be going on for years to come. And God knows what this means for Turkey and Kurds, but let's open those can of biscuits on another day. This shifting gears here and going, but staying on murder. There's an old joke that I've been reminded of recently about how I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out in Midtown Manhattan last week. There was a brutal assassination of a 50-year-old business executive, and somehow a health policy debate broke out in the August newspapers of the land. United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson was gunned down on the street by a grinning and kind of handsome young hoodie wearing guy who had reportedly written on his bullets casings the words delay, deny, and depose in apparent a reference to tactics that health insurance companies stand accused of preferring when they refuse to cover life-saving treatments. To the surprise of many, including me, a bunch of overly online, mostly left of center, morally cretinous ghouls led unsurprisingly by former New York Times and Washington Post social media columnist Taylor Lorenz have cheered on the assassination, going so far in Lorenz's case to post the identifying information of other healthcare executives while arguing that the health insurance industry, we can just call it the insurancy, sure, is directly responsible for tens of thousands of deaths that don't get as mourned as much as Brian Thompson's. Peterson's health care policy discussion has indeed broken out, whether we appreciate the premise or not. Can we start with what's being said about that? Within a reasonable time frame, I'm hitting the clock now, could you walk us through some of the common critiques that we've been hearing over the last several days about UnitedHealth and other insurance companies? And maybe compare those to reality and then give a sense of why the actual reality works the way that it does. Go.
Wow, that's an awful lot. I could write you a book, but instead of doing that, what I'm going to say is that the complaints about UnitedHealth are basically that UnitedHealth denies claims. And there's some data to suggest that UnitedHealth denies claims at higher rates than other insurers, perhaps at the highest rate of any of the private health insurance companies, or the major ones anyway. And so people are mad at that about that. And in some ways, I can understand that because that sucks. Health insurance bureaucracy is deeply unpleasant to deal with, and getting rejected on something where you feel like this is vital or necessary or has been recommended by a doctor, that is, it's no fun. No one likes that. So I'm not going to say like, oh, this is just wonderful. At the same time, what is your preferred system is the question that I want to ask, because every single healthcare system in the developed world that exists in some ways rations care or denies care somehow or another. And sometimes that's done through wait times. In Canada and the United Kingdom in particular, you just have incredibly long lines for wait. So they pretend that they just have, that care is just sort of generally available, free at the point of care for everyone. And it's just, it's there and it's equal. And the thing is that the way they do that is that in the United Kingdom, you're going to wait 14, 18, and possibly more than that number of weeks in order to see a doctor in order to get treated. In Canada, it is similar. Care is rationed through waiting. And so that's the way that they do that. And it's the government that does that. And it's the government that says, you can't have this or you can't have it right now. And so every single system has that. Some other systems also deal with their care issues by, say, paying providers, much less. So in France, for example, but also in the UK, doctors make an awful lot less money. And we saw a related debate about that touched on this happen in the United States just over the past week or two, where the anesthesiologists were complaining that there was a health insurer that was like, we're going to put new rules on how much we're going to pay you based on the time that you spend in surgery and that sort of thing. Basically, it was a move designed to limit how much anesthesiologists get paid. Anesthesiologists, on average, make something like $440,000 to $450,000 a year, and they're doing pretty well. And so this was an insurer basically saying, we're going to pay something like Medicare rates and use that to try and push back on what we believe is excessive payments to anesthesiologists. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the payments are excessive or that Medicare's rates are right. But what I am going to tell you is that there has to be some sort of pressure in the system not to overconsume. Otherwise, you end up with a system that cannot provide. There's always going to be someone who says, there's going to be a decision point somewhere, whether it is the government or whether it is a health insurance company, that is going to say, in some cases, you are not going to get this care. We are going to ration this. We are going to allocate this accordingly. And because we have so systematically suppressed prices all throughout the healthcare system, we don't have a good way of doing that. Instead, we have these kind of random, arbitrary, bureaucratic systems that make everything opaque, that make it hard to figure out what's going on. That's true in the government systems. It's true in the highly regulated private, public-private system, of which a huge amount of healthcare spending in the United States, by the way, is government spending, not private. So whatever system you have, there is going to be someone who at some point says no. We don't have prices, which are the best way to allocate scarce resources. What we need in healthcare are real markets, real prices, and real market signals. We don't have that. And it makes people mad because what this system tells you is you're not like it. The system just constantly says, you can't have this, and we're not really going to explain why.
Catherine, if we're grading on a curve of people will die, can you think of any other policy sort of disagreements in which one side is advocating and sometimes winning out on a set of government policies that could tangibly and almost definitely will tangibly lead to more deaths than if not?
All government policies are that in the end, I suppose.
Wow.
If you're an anarchist.
Well, I'm actually not sure what I was supposed to say. I think you were prompting me to say something, but I really do believe it's kind of all policies. So
donate to Reason and this will get better.
Yeah.
Yes.
Gifts donate to Reason matched. Is what I wanted to say. This comes up absolutely everywhere. And it shows up in the National Highway Transportation Safety calculus about whether or not they need to mandate that your car makes a loud beep when you get too close to the bumper in front of you. It shows up in NASA deciding whether they should spend $1 billion for every rocket launch to make sure that not one astronaut dies. It shows up, you know, in ways that make people uncomfortable in all of the, of course, in the COVID vaccination and lockdown debate. And it makes people uncomfortable every single time it happens because on a very fundamental level, we would like to not have to choose. We would like to never, ever have to say no to something that might save someone's life or improve someone's quality of life. But in the end, to say yes to every single one of those things is to, demand and take the labor of the people who provide those things, sometimes against their consent, and also to never achieve it. It's like it's impossible. So I guess I think every debate is about this, and it's sort of childish and frustrating that the way that this one has played out is for people to be like, yeah, get 'em, about this man who's just trying to run a profitable company that provides valuable services.
Two other things to just note very quickly are that health insurance companies tend to have very low profit margins, 5% or less, sometimes even quite a bit less than that. And they are legally required, in fact, to spend 80 or 85% of their total revenues on healthcare. So that effectively puts a profit ceiling. The other thing is here that what we're fundamentally talking about is trade-offs. And what people don't like is the idea that there are trade-offs in healthcare in every single system. And there's a big contingent, particularly on the left in the United States, that is devoted to the idea that there don't have to be trade-offs and other countries don't have trade-offs. That is simply false. Every single country with any healthcare system that exists has trade-offs. I'm sorry, it's true. That's just the way the world works.
Nick, I'm old enough to remember when Barack Hussein Obama was giving State of the Union addresses, crowing, dunking the football, as they say in sports.
Sounds perfect.
Yep.
Nailed it.
Because he shouted down, he beat back the health insurance lobbyists in pushing through Obamacare, which, you know, many really smart people like Ezra Klein pointed out that people will die if it doesn't get passed. And Elizabeth Warren in 2017, when Donald Trump was thinking about overturning it, pointed out that people will die if it gets changed in any way, shape or form. Is it odd to you that people who presumably were cheering on the passage of health care are now cheering on the assassination of insurance company executives, given that Obama has already declared victory over them?
I haven't quite seen Elizabeth Warren's tweet saying, you know, do it again, you know. But to your point, one of the things that I find, you know, first, let's just say that people who are like, yeah, you go, guy, you know, when somebody gets shot, you know, in the morning on a street in Manhattan, that's just, they're fucked up. There is a part of the left, there's a version of this on the right, that is losing everything. And they are just going to become more and more ridiculous and ugly and horrific versions of their true selves. And we're witnessing that. You know, we've seen that in various kinds of you know, spasmodic episodes. And this is the latest on that. And, you know, these are these are dead enders who will never become powerful. But, you know, as they shrink, they're going to get just harder and harder, because this is, you know, this is the politics of purity and also of social media, you know, kind of enthusiasm and out of control stupidity. One of the things though, related to this is, you know, whenever we're talking about healthcare, two things come up, you know, for me, that people never seem to think about. And the first is, why aren't doctors working for free? Like, why, when we talk about healthcare costs, you know, Peter mentioned briefly the anesthesiologist stuff. You know, it's like, you know, doctors are never told, oh, well, you know what, you have to work for half as much money. We say, oh, insurance companies, you can make half as much money, or you shouldn't make any profits. Sometimes we'll say patients, you know, you shouldn't be so fat and you shouldn't go to the doctor all the time. But we don't even really do that. But doctors have really rigged the system so well that during the Obamacare discussions, nobody said, how do we 10x the number of healthcare providers? Because if you increase the supply of something, the cost of it will go down. That just like never came up. And, you know, the fact is that like there aren't, you know, there hasn't been an increase in medical school, you know, slots or in residency slots, you know, commensurate with growth in population or anything like that. Doctors make a huge amount of money. They also structure a huge amount of who is able to provide medicine and medical assistance and things like that. And if we're going to have a conversation about healthcare, and we should, and health insurance, we ought to be talking about doctors, because they are a major, major feature of it. They get to call all the shots, and somehow they're invisible in all of the conversations.
I kind of disagree with that framing.
Wait, you're saying doctors don't make money, doctors never get called out for making too much money, and doctors don't actually structure the system?
Yeah, you're right. That's what I was saying. I'm all done now.
Okay.
Go on.
No, I'm just saying.
I don't think that's what she was saying.
What's wrong with the framing? That doctors
share.
Are part of the problem.
Yeah. Yes, so no? I guess what I would say is, in general, like the word rigged system is, or the phrase rigged system is kind of everywhere right now. Even frequently used by people who have benefited from those rigged systems. See Donald Trump saying that the election was rigged even when he won it twice. But It's just a bad system. And I think
What does that mean? It's just a bad
who
system.
Who is the person who rigged it? Who can we point the finger at? Who can we blame? Gets you, in its most extreme form, this murder. And I think it's
Nick
actually that.
That's
the healthcare executive.
I think absolutely there are doctors in the system and doctors' institutions in the system who are bad actors. There are insurers in the system who are bad actors. But they are, this is, to me, this is like an opportunity for just a public choice critique. Like everyone is responding to incentives in a system that is so out of whack from reality that it no longer hardly even makes sense to talk about the moral culpability of anyone within it. Now, that
I'm not talking about the moral culpability. I'm talking about the economic impact of the American Medical Association, of various kinds of boards that certify healthcare providers, all of whom are interested. Yeah. I mean, they meter out who is allowed to do stuff. So, like, that's a major part of the problem.
Yeah, it is a part of the problem. But I guess what I want to say is the phrasing of doctors, I just find to be a little off base there in exactly the way that I find like insurance CEOs are to blame is wrong. Like the whole system is not serving people well. It is not serving people well. And it is entrenched thanks to the state and especially in recent memory in the U.S., thanks to Obamacare. But it would be, to me, far more useful to just do a structural critique.
I think Catherine is right that it's mostly incentives.
I thought I was making a structural critique.
You guys actually agree with each other, so go ahead.
So if the other thing that I wanted to say is that, you know, the biggest problem is that, you know, patients or, you know, people, healthcare consumers, don't have the amount of autonomy that they should. We, at Reason, we just went through our enrollment period, you know, and it's great. We have pretty good health insurance and it's pretty well priced and all of that, but it's one provider. And it's like, if I don't like the people our healthcare company, you know, networks with and things like that, I'm kind of screwed because it's very difficult to buy insurance on the private market, et cetera. Car insurance is annoying and frustrating. But car insurance, you have more choices as an individual consumer of this. So, you know, anything, and I hesitate to also acknowledge that just as doctors are the problem, the state is the problem, patients are also a problem. But we need to have more autonomy in the system. And the more consumer choice we have, generally speaking, the more satisfied customers will be because you can go around to different places.
Peter, the incentives are screwed up all over. Right. And this is the problem is that everywhere you look in the healthcare system, there are no good incentives. And so for people who have private insurance and are employed, you have a system of third party payment that is tied to the employer. And that is a result of World War II era wage and price controls where where the federal government because there were wage controls, they decided to give a tax carve out to fringe benefits, including health insurance, which meant that in the post-war era, most health insurance ended up coming through employers. Then after that, you ended up with Medicare and Medicaid coming into the system. So prior to the existence of Medicare and Medicaid, the United States spent consistently about 5 to 6% of GDP on healthcare. Now it's more like 18% of GDP, give or take. And that a big part of that is that Medicare and Medicaid came in and became these huge third-party government payers. And so everywhere you have this third-party payment system in which individuals who have to make choices for themselves are not actually responsible for paying for their care, but the people who pay for care are also, they're mostly just responsible for kind of trying to save money, but they're not really responsible for the lives and the health of the people. People have mistaken health insurance for health care. These are not the same things. Health insurance is a financial product primarily designed to protect you from financial risk. Health care is something totally different, but of course they are highly intertwined. I sometimes joke at Reason that basically all stories can be reduced to either zoning or healthcare finance. And this kind of shows you, it's kind of like almost everything in like, when you look at the government, when you look at what it spends, it's just all healthcare finance. And if you've solved the healthcare finance problem for the federal government, you wouldn't quite solve all the government problems, but the big picture spending debt deficit issues would not be serious in the way that they are serious. And this is true in basically in a very large number of first world Western countries that have big healthcare systems, is that the big reason that they have fiscal issues, that their budgets don't work, is because of entitlements generally and healthcare benefits in particular. These things are just too expensive. They are designed in a way that have bad incentives all throughout the system, and everybody suffers as a result.
As ever, go Switzerland. All right, we're going to get to our listener question of the week here in a moment. But first, friends, you know what season it is. Three words for you. Holiday work parties, or maybe it's holiday office parties. I think holiday office parties. Anyways, three words, a lot of pain, potentially a brutal time for morning productivity. For instance, this Wednesday morning, if I'm just like pulling a time out of a hat, it doesn't have to be that way. However, thanks to a little thing we like to call pre-alcohol. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It is this byproduct and not dehydration that's to blame for your rough morning after. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night. Then Drink your eggnog responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. So go to zbiotics.com/roundtable to learn more about this delightful piece of science and get 15% off your first order when you use Roundtable at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, head over to zbiotics.com/roundtable, use the code Roundtable at checkout for 15% off. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Happy holidays and such. All right. Reminder to email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. And thank you for everyone who sent all the bonus webathon Ask Us Anything emails, which we addressed on a special bonus episode last week. This latest one comes from Spencer from San Francisco, who writes, with the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, December 7th, and the recently observed anniversary of JFK's assassination on November 22nd, that's foreshadowing, by the way, for later, I've come to notice how many, many libertarians are completely convinced of conspiracy theories that the CIA killed JFK. Wait, I thought you said conspiracy theory. Or Pearl Harbor was allowed to happen by FDR as examples. The common pattern seems to be that libertarians believe in these not on the strength of the evidence, but because it confirms their beliefs, whatever those beliefs may be. If they are anti-war libertarians who believe U.S. participation in World War II was unjust, then Pearl Harbor was FDR's doing. JFK was assassinated by the CIA to get us deeper into Vietnam, and George Bush blew up the Twin Towers to invade Iraq, and so on. My question to you all is, aren't libertarians supposed to be skeptics? Isn't that why the magazine is called Reason? Why are so many libertarians such gullible idiots when it comes to believing obviously bogus conspiracy theories simply because they help simplify a narrative? Are conspiracy-driven beliefs getting worse among libertarians, or has it always been this way? I'm only laughing, Spencer, and the listeners at large, because I really enjoy saying, hey, Catherine, can you go ahead and insult your audience? Go ahead.
Thanks, Matt. I'd love to. Yeah, I actually don't think libertarians have a disproportionate representation of conspiracy theorists in our midst because it validates our libertarianism. I think it is methodological rather than about the conclusions. I think that if you look around the world, look around your country, and you see explanations for why things are the way they are that other people disagree with, you start to think, hey, maybe a lot of the explanations that I've been given for things are wrong on other stuff too. So if you look around and you're like, hey, maybe the government shouldn't solve our problems, but everyone around you is like, I think the government should solve our problems, and it's just a question of which government and which problems, you might then be like, what else is everyone else getting wrong? My thinking on this, of course, is informed by Reason's own conspiracy theory correspondent, Jesse Walker, who has written a truly excellent book about the United States of Paranoia, sort of cool little history of various forms of conspiracism, and most recently has written a really good piece for the magazine about how the left-right spectrum is a lie. Or something like that. He would probably object to that characterization. But the kind of eternal horseshoeing of all ideological tidbits into a vast and confusing morass. He also observed this morning that the edgelords and the tutters are really switching places with this CEO assassination. Everybody who was absolutely horrified at the edgelording on the right is now like, oh, maybe it's cool to kill CEOs. And we expect those positions to swap. So all of this is to say libertarians are used to being in a minority. I think they look around at other minority positions and wonder if they might be true. And that leads them to weird conspiracy theory places. The only conspiracy theory I believe in is the one that Peter Suderman has been putting forth for years, that Satoshi Nakamoto is at least in part actually Neal Stephenson. Thank you.
That's pretty good. Nick, you've been around for a while in these.
Forever.
Forever, just like Satoshi. Are there waves of this, and are we up at the crest of one?
Well, first off, to agree a bit with Catherine, one of the things, if you're a libertarian and you look at the way the government has acted, you become receptive to the idea that if you can dream it, the government has done it. And if you read histories of things like, MK Ultra, which was a government plan where at, various points, the CIA bought up the world supply of LSD, and then started, you know, giving it to doctors and researchers and prison wardens and things like that to use in unspeakable ways. And it's all true, but it reads like a conspiracy theory. If they can do that, they can do just about anything, or they will try to do just about anything, including, you know, impregnating scuba diving suits for Fidel Castro with LSD to drive him mad, or giving him exploding cigars. So, you know, there's that as a backdrop. To the reader's particular question, though, I do think libertarian, there is a growing band of conspiracy thinking people that are, you know, coming to the fore in the Libertarian Party or and in the libertarian movement. There's different waves of this stuff. People like Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman at various points kind of dominated the mind space of libertarianism. Neither of them were conspiracists. They were both, you know, they had very, you know, kind of systematic ways of looking at stuff, but they were not conspiracy thinkers. Somebody like Ron Paul, who has been one of the dominant figures in the libertarian movement since, you know, for a long time, but especially since his 2008 run, Ron Paul thinks in conspiracist terms. You know, he talks about the North American Union. He talks about a lot of shadowy forces. People who identify with him often talk in terms of grand designs and conspiracies, and it's the, you know, the monster from Jekyll Island that created the Federal Reserve, et cetera. I think that kind of thinking is, you know, is surging among libertarians to a point where you get somebody like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is everybody's, you know, perfect example of somebody who is a conspiracy person. He thinks everything is a conspiracy of one sort or another, and he has high status among many people who call themselves libertarians. So I think there is a surge in it. I think it gives people some comfort. It gives people, you know, a way of explaining a world that goes against them. And it also makes everybody a little bit more important, because if there's a grand scheme afoot, you know, while it might rub you out, you can also unmask it and then become a big deal.
Peter, how would you answer this question?
I want to take you back to 2006 and a Scripps Howard poll that asked respondents, how likely is it that people in the federal government either assisted in the 9/11 attacks or took no action to stop the attacks because they wanted the United States to go to war with the Middle East? 22.6% of Democrats said it was very likely, and another 28% said that it was somewhat likely. So I think, you know, this idea that only libertarians or that libertarians are especially prone to believing things that flatter their crazy things that believe that flatter their ideological predispositions is not quite right. That's just true of people. People believe stuff that is flattering to their to the things they already believe, that sort of that it confirm them whether or not they are going to be true. And I think for libertarians, the thing is that they are skeptical of authority. And because they are skeptical of authority, they are going to be skeptical of official authoritative narratives and storylines. And sometimes that's going to mean they believe things that are maybe not totally true. But in other cases, that's actually going to be that's actually going to mean that they believe things that are quite possibly true, plausibly true. For example, go back to 2020 when we were told for a solid year, maybe more, that the lab leak, the idea of a lab leak was simply a conspiracy theory. There was no way it could be true. And now I think, you know, there's been at least one congressional report that came out just within the last week or two that said that it was the most likely story. I don't think we know for certain that that COVID was a lab leak. At the same time, it's pretty plausible. And you could make a decent argument that it is the most plausible of the explanations. We were told it was a conspiracy theory. The authorities said it was a conspiracy theory to believe that. And libertarians were more likely to be skeptical because libertarians are skeptical of authority. And that explains an awful lot of the phenomenon that our listener has identified.
I will just append a recommendation to read a piece from our great senior editor, Brian Doherty, from like 12 years ago or so, called A Tale of Two Libertarianisms, that gets into like two of the main kind of streams of it, roughly understood as Austrian versus Chicago, but that's crude for a lot of different reasons. It's sort of a shorthand, but it's very interesting. And I think that that split contains a lot of this. So whichever of those two strains happen to be on the upswing, you're probably going to see more of this type of thing. Then also, as Peter was alluding to, too, when the elite is systematically gaslighting you on a constant basis about any number of things, not least of which is Joe Biden's cognitive ability to be president of the United States and a bunch of COVID policies besides, of course, you're going to get people who just start as a opening gambit to not believe what you're saying. And they're going to have some cause for that. I still think that doesn't absolve you from using your actual brain tubes, but I can understand where this is coming from. All right. Let's get to as quickly as humanly possible. Just the reporting in the wake of the Hunter Biden pardon. Now it's being told that President Biden is considering, he's trial ballooning a bunch of other preemptive pardons for people who are presumed to be in the crosshairs of the incoming Trump administration. Some names have included Liz Cheney, Anthony Fauci, Adam Schiff, among others. Let's just do a quick round of what we think about the morality, the constitutionality, legality of the idea of blanket pardons stretching back in time to cover people who haven't been accused of any crimes. Catherine, you start.
Seems bad. Seems like a bad idea. Seems like it'll set bad precedents and solidify in-group, out-group, and tribal sentiments as administrations turn over. Seems like it implies the kind of stuff that gets conspiracy theorists going, because maybe they have a lot to hide and they want to not have that become discovered in a variety of criminal proceedings. Seems bad. Don't do that. Don't do big blanket pardons for all your buddies, even if the guy coming in after you is an asshole.
Nick, if you were the outgoing president, would you preemptively pardon me?
No, I would convict you. I think the president also has the ability to convict people unilaterally. Yeah. I will point out that like many of the people on the Trump hate list, I will be out of the country. When the new year starts, I was going to say when Congress convenes. I don't know where I'll be during the inauguration, but I don't really care. I think the most interesting thing to me about this is that this would be a precedent setting or a norm busting action by a president, again, in the name of protecting us from that big buster of norms, Donald Trump. This is just an infinite regress, that has hounded the Democrats. So in a poetic way, it would be nice to see Joe Biden do this. The other thing I'll recommend people to do is to watch the long Meet the Press interview that Donald Trump did on Sunday. And he's sounding very reasonable and rational. He's still bad on a lot of policies, particularly mass deportations. But, I don't think there's reasons to worry that he is going to activate the Justice Department to go after his enemies any more than he did the first time around, which he did not.
Peter?
I'm just glad we have one party in this great country that is devoted to upholding democratic norms.
Which one?
That's Libertarian Party anymore, right?
Joke. Peace and freedom.
Yeah, working families.
The cocktail party.
There it is.
Birthday party. Seems bad.
The lemon party, Matt, as long as we're going through the list.
Don't listen out there. I know some of you guys are older listeners and you're not
Stop
unfamiliar with the
doing
internet.
This. I am going to put a blanket ban on Lemon Party references on this podcast. I swear to God.
What?
I will turn this podcast right around.
Yeah. Google Gary Johnson and Lemon Party.
No!
Please don't do that. Yeah.
This is all going to be edited out with a deep for a good 45 minutes.
Can't believe we got through the whole serious segment without a what is Aleppo joke.
Yeah.
You know, did we now, Peter? That's the question. Yeah.
Turns out we didn't.
He gave a great answer about Syria after that. That was on Morning Joe. And Mike Barnicle, the great truth teller and one of the greatest fiction writers of the 20th century, who somehow continues to work despite, being caught time and again doing that. Johnson's answer on Aleppo was exactly right.
You know, Nick, I would read that.
Yeah.
In case you... want to rewrite that.
Syria's in the news right now. So if there was if someone wanted to write something about Aleppo and libertarians, that'd be relevant.
It's the spice you put on your chicken kebabs.
It is. It's so delicious.
Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
Okay, so I watched Separated, which is a new documentary that aired over the weekend on MSNBC. It's directed by Errol Morris, the Academy Award winner of Thin Blue Line, Fog of War, and a number of other great movies, including one with Steve Bannon. And this, he uses the journalistic work primarily of Jacob Soboroff, a journalist, to talk about Trump's family separation / zero tolerance policy that he put into place in late 2017. And then once it became public in 2018, he pulled it back. This is there were about 5,500 kids who were separated from their families as they crossed the border. It's a great documentary because it shows that this policy was definitely put in place, but everybody involved in it was claiming deniability, like that they didn't know where it came from. It just showed up and it did, you know, and then suddenly it was happening. And then when the public got wind of it, you know, everybody was like, oh, yeah, we're not going to do this anymore. It's a great documentary from a libertarian point of view or public choice point of view, if you will, regardless of the content, because it just shows how things happen in government in ways that are purposeful, but, you know, kind of escape any real direct understanding or culpability among people. So I highly recommend Separated. I interviewed Errol Morris, who I've interviewed a couple of times for Reason, as well as Jacob Soboroff. That'll be the Reason interview this Wednesday. The documentary will be on video on demand on December 17th. Separated. It's a great case study in government abuse of humans, and it's also a great documentary.
Peter, what did you consume?
So I have been watching Yellowstone over the past year. Oh. Finally caught up. Okay, I don't think I've seen last night's episode, but I'm basically caught up at this point. And earlier I said that at Reason I sometimes joke that nearly every story that we cover is either about healthcare financing or zoning. Well, this one is about zoning. It really is just a show about zoning. It's this sprawling Western, deeply American epic about legacy and wealth and family and like meaning and purpose. But no, really, actually, it's just a story about land use regulation in Montana. And it's soapy and sort of ridiculous, increasingly so as this show goes on. At the same time, it's also pretty damn enjoyable. It is beautiful with just incredible sort of countryside vistas that show off, you know, some of America's great natural beauty. Kevin Costner, who was in the show right up until this last set of episodes, is just a great commanding central presence as the patriarch of this old ranch. And really, it's a show about a guy who is trying at all costs to preserve his piece of land and his, which he believes is his family legacy. And what you see in this show is I think that it gets at something that you rarely see on television, which is the conservative mind. Because what it is fundamentally about is Kevin Costner's character doing anything he can to keep things from changing. And in fact, he says this at one point at the end of, I believe, I want to say season four, he ends up winning the governor's office. He doesn't want the job, but he realizes he has to take it because it's the only way he can stop all the developments that he wants to stop from happening. And his pitch to voters in the state of Montana is, I am the opposite of progress. He like says almost exactly those words. And so if you want a fictional window into the conservative mind in the Trump era, I think you could do, like, I don't think there is a better show, a better piece of fiction than Yellowstone, which really just shows that this is about ensuring that nothing ever gets to change, that no one ever gets to make money off of something new, that everything has to stay exactly the way it is. And there is something wonderful and beautiful and compelling about that worldview. It is also, I think, a bad worldview that stops good things from happening. And yet, you see a sympathetic portrayal of this idea that nothing should ever really change, and in particular, the land should never really change, because that's the way it's been. In some ways, in their minds, it's for all time, but in fact, it's actually only since they've been there. And so it's a very good show, very soapy, kind of ridiculous, and it is just about to finish. I think next Sunday is the final episode of the fifth season, and I think of the show.
Awesome. Catherine, what did you consume?
So I consumed something that my algorithm brought to me this morning. I talked a couple weeks ago about how I, for reasons that are quite unclear to me, got kind of offered up the chick lit rom-com assisted suicide novel that I recommended. But this one is very clear to me. So I want to give you a little backstory and then I will quickly recommend my thing. The backstory is, first of all, I've been reading a lot about Syria, just like everyone else. Also, for my own midlife crisis, lady-related reasons, have become obsessed with the Sumerian myth of Inanna, which is like an underworld story.
Wait, isn't that a subplot in Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash?
I mean, she's everywhere, Peter, is what I learned. But the thing that my algorithm gave me this morning was a paper in the academic journal Antiquity, which is about how they found a bunch of bulls in Iraq and Syria. And these bulls, according to these archaeologists, suggest that the very, very, very earliest experiments with the state, which arose in sort of the early complex and dense societies in the fourth millennium BC in Mesopotamia, looks like they tried a state or a state-like entity or public institutions or something. And you can tell because of this very, very large number of bulls that have like meat residue in them. It's complicated. I'm not going to explain it here. And then they decided maybe the state wasn't a great idea for 1,500 years after that. But there is no evidence of violence or other kind of disaster. It seems like maybe everyone came together in one of the very, very first cities, tried a state, ate a bunch of meat soup, and then said, I think we will go back to decentralized living. And I love that so much. I don't know if it's true. I can barely understand this paper because it is not written for me, but I want to believe.
You want to believe?
So are you going to publish the recipe for anti-state stew?
I'm going to look into it. I think they're basically, what they can tell is like a lot of marrow fat, like lipids from marrow in the bulls.
Would it have been like llamas or something?
Well, there was also some dairy in there. It's unclear.
I just hope there were no seed oils.
They talk about some seed-based foods as well in the bulls. But this is a part of the world that is obviously at this very moment, in a disastrous, horrific, probably, you know, violent already, potentially soon to be a more violent situation. And I just found this story of the peaceful dissolution of the first go at something like a state to be beautiful and inspiring.
So I consumed the latest in the never-ending extension of the Beatles intellectual property, which is a Disney Plus documentary called Beatles 64, which, unlike Get Back, is probably the best recent version of a Beatles thing that's kind of like, oh, you should probably see that. It's pretty awesome. It's fine. It's basically all about when the Beatles came to New York in February of 1964 and went on the Ed Sullivan Show and stayed in their Park Plaza hotel while screaming teenage girls were outside and were pretty bored, played a show in Washington and went home. And they have extra footage that they hadn't shown somehow after all these years. And they frame it as like, you know, this was part of healing America after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And then there's some Marshall McLuhan stuff in there. Fine, whatever. The part about that's actually interesting, and I say this as a Beatles fan, so I'm going to consume all of this kind of content, is they actually spent a lot of time on contemporaneous footage interviewing the 14-year-olds who are screaming and losing their minds outside of the Park Plaza. And Nick Gillespie, it is the greatest festival of New York accents you've ever seen in your life, and just like beehive haircuts, and it's fantastic. And it also like, it kind of gets into the mindset, and they also interview some of these women 60 years later, describing what was happening to them at that time. And it's kind of awesome. It's like the agency of 14-year-old losing their mind Beatlemania groupies. And I'm absolutely here for that. Really great. And the killer shot, they show a Puerto Rican girl with her family just watching the Ed Sullivan Show on TV. And she's just like, her hands don't know what to do. They're sort of distractingly touching her face. Like she's just experiencing impossible to comprehend emotions at dealing with the Beatles in early 1964. Terrific. I love all of that. That plus there's a Smokey Robinson and the Miracles version of Yesterday, which is much better than pretty much any Beatles song ever recorded. Unbelievable on the Ed Sullivan Show. Ed, so go check that out. Anyways, Beatles 64, produced by Martin Scorsese, has the usual, you know, last cut executive producer problem of the Beatles participating. Paul McCartney does a few things that are interesting, and everyone else is kind of limp, and that's it. But it's worth watching Nick Gillespie if you haven't seen it.
And Captain, so this goes into the DC show. That was at like was called the Coliseum back then, because there's the facility is near where I live, and it's now an REI. It's just like a coffee shop and a climbing wall where you can buy like a Patagonia vest.
It's a pretty insane thing to see, because it was like a boxing ring, and they're playing kind of in the round on a boxing ring. And Ringo almost toppled over the riser, and it just seems like a pretty animalistic show. Would have been pretty awesome to have been there, and they interviewed some people who were there, and so it was pretty great. But anyways, I'm just seeing as we're stopping here that Daniel Penny has been cleared of criminal wrongdoing in New York for the chokehold death of Jordan Neely on the crowded F train here in Manhattan. He was acquitted of criminally negligent homicide after they tossed the manslaughter charge late last week. So just throwing that out there, that is news that is happening in the world. Let us bid you adieu. One last pitch to the webathon, reason.com/webathon. We have been doing pretty well so far, tracking numbers in previous years, and we want to, there's a matching grant that's active as of now. We'll see if it's still active by the time this thing comes out. And basically it ends on Tuesday. So please consider your tax deductible donation. Peter, do you want to say some brief words about our upcoming Reason versus in the boxing match in Washington, D.C.?
The very first installment of Reason Versus is going to be next week at the Howard Theater in Washington, D.C. It's going to be Reason Versus the Bulwark, and we're going to talk about taking sides in politics. The proposition that is you don't have to take sides in politics, and that's what Matt and Nick are going to be defending, and the folks at the Bulwark are going to be arguing the opposite. It's going to be a good time. Again, it's at the Howard Theater in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, December 18th. You can get tickets right now at reason.com/events. That's reason.com/events. This is the first in a series of debates that we hope we will be having regularly over the next several months and years.
If you thought the Beatles made people hysterical, you know, just wait for Reason Versus.
It is a fantastic venue. We were we got to go in and look at it just a couple of days ago, and it's going to be a good time.
Nick, are there any other DC or what city we're in? New York events that you want to hype, or we fallow?
We are, the next one's going to be in January, so look soon for Reason at reason.com/events, or go to reason.com/newsletters and sign up for the NYC events newsletter, and you'll be the first to know.
Terrific. Look at all of our podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, Dr. Nick Gillespie, at reason.com/podcast. Thanks for being with us on the roundtable, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.
All the costs, the effects, the results, empathize with each other as if we were adults, use our brains to craft arguments, not vilify, see that freedom's a traitor.
You want people to die!
I tried. Crossing the street is incredibly tough. People look left and right, but rarely look up. My bill would mandate.